Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Hello to our Behind the Knife listeners. I'm welcoming back the colorectal oncology surgery team, including myself, Winnie Zombre, Phil Bauer, and Dr. J. Joshua Smith. Today, we have an outstanding panel of guests joining us. Dr. Garcia Aguilar, who is the Benno C. Schmidt Chair in Surgical Oncology, the Chief of Colorectal Service in the Department of Surgery at MSK, the Director of Colorectal Cancer Research Center at MSK, and the Professor of Surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College. We also have Dr. Benjamin Schlechter, Senior Physician in the Gastrointestinal Cancer Center at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Also joining us, we have Dr. Emmanuel Focas, Professor and Chairman at the Department of Radiation Oncology, part of the CyberKnife and Radiotherapy Faculty of Medicine at the University Hospital of Cologne in Germany. We appreciate you all taking the time to discuss our topic today, total neoadjuvant therapy in locally advanced rectal cancer. Winnie, can you please provide us some background?
Of course, Janet. Locally advanced rectal cancer includes CT3, that is tumor invading through the muscularis propria into the subserosa, and CT4 tumors, that is tumors that has penetrated the outer layers or serosa invading at adjacent organs or structures, or tumors involving local regional lymph nodes in addition to any T stage with node positive disease. It should be noted that CT3N0M0 tumors also fall into this category.
NCCN guidelines recommend total neoadjuvant therapy as a current standard of care for all non-metastatic locally advanced disease, but this varies slightly from European recommendations. According to ESMO guidelines, TNT should be considered for high-risk tumors in the surgical setting. These are defined as clinical T4 tumors, those with concern for mesorectal fascia involvement, clinical node N2 tumors, positive extramural vascular invasion or EMVI, or lateral lymph node enlargement of greater than or equal to 7 millimeters. In the organ preservation setting, the ESMO guidelines for TNT are the same as the OPRA trial, which we will discuss shortly. With that background, Dr. Schlechter, could you please provide us a history of TNT and which studies laid the groundwork for these recommendations?
Yeah, happy to. So I think we have a pre-TME era and a TME era. And so the TME era really changed practice. So first we have the Swedish rectal cancer trial, which looked at short course radiation followed by surgery. But this is a trial in which surgery was not standardized. And neoadjuvant radiation did improve local control and overall survival. Subsequently, we had the Dutch trial, which addressed the same question of neoadjuvant radiation, but standardized TME across all institutions. And this was led by Dr. Held. So the local recurrence rates were improved in both arms, and there was still an improvement in local control in patients that received neoadjuvant radiation, even when TME was optimized, although overall survival benefit was less. So in 2004, there was the AIO-94, the German rectal cancer trial group, but demonstrated preoperative chemoradiation reduced the rates of local recurrence and acute and long-term toxic effects. The American NSABP R03 trial had similar results, but treatment compliance was improved and there was increased sphincter preservation, which obviously is important for patients. So neoadjuvant chemoradiation followed by TME plus or minus adjuvant therapy was adopted as a standard of care worldwide. And by 2014, we had the ADORS trial coming out of the UK, which really standardized FOLFOX as the adjuvant chemotherapy. You know, this strategy offered good local control, but there were some important lessons. So first, a significant portion of patients never received the intended post-op chemotherapy, often because they were still recovering from surgery, they had complications, and there's just delays in treatment. And as a result, this really allows micrometastatic disease to progress unchecked during this long interval. And we want to obviously avoid micrometastatic disease. As a medical oncologist, metastatic disease is sort of my business. And so there was reasons to think that we could fill the space in the new adjuvant setting with the chemotherapy that was offered adjuvantly based on the ADORS trial. So at this same time, the interval between radiation and surgery was being evaluated, and the Stockholm 3 trial looked at short course radiation with a delay to surgery or short course radiation with immediate surgery. And this showed that a delay to surgery led to a tenfold increase in pathologic complete response. So that's really impressive. This also highlighted the value of time for regression, but concerns persisted about delaying surgery and avoiding systemic therapy. And so some timing trials and four successive trials looked at progressively longer radiation to surgery intervals and filling that time with modified FOLFOX or CAPOX. The rate of pathologic complete response essentially doubled with these trials from 18 to 38%, supporting the idea that additional time between radiation and surgery can enhance tumor response and that we can prolong disease-free survival and potentially allow non-operative management, but importantly also get in the chemo that we oncologists like to get in. So by shifting systemic therapy and radiation therapy into the pre-op period, patients are more likely to get all of the intended therapy. We're more likely to address micrometastatic disease with chemotherapy. And we're more likely to essentially achieve benefits for patients, including complete responses. Ultimately, TNT in this era, the sort of the later part of the TME era, I would say is the TNT era, is associated with higher rates of PathCR, which opens the door for organ preservation, things that patients and surgeons really, really want, and opens the door for non-operative management and watch and wait strategies, and in some cases, improves the chance of sphincter preservation for lower tumors.
Thank you, Dr. Schlechter, for that nice overview. It should be noted that some recent studies have aimed to identify the optimal type of radiation, dosing, even chemotherapy regimens to be used, and then the sequencing of treatment based on some of what you just discussed, including the timing trial. So two examples are the Rapido study and the Prodige 23 trials, both randomized trials that were two landmark studies incorporating this idea of total neoadjuvant therapy that certainly deserve further review. Both showed higher rates of pathologic complete response when using a total neoadjuvant approach and improvement of the oncologic outcomes measured in both of the studies. Rapido was interesting because it used a short course radiation approach followed by 4 months of either FOLFOX or CAPOX versus just the standard long course chemoradiation followed by TME surgery and then adjuvant therapy. The 5-year outcomes showed that short course TNT doubled the PathCR rates compared to long course chemoradiation and showed improved oncologic outcomes as measured in the trial. However, and notably, long-term data revealed a higher local regional failure rate in this trial. And this led to the question, the use of short course radiation in this context. In the Prodige 23 trial, which utilized FOLFIRINOX, and this was 6 cycles followed by long course chemoradiation compared to the standard approach at the time, long course chemoradiation followed by TME surgery and then adjuvant chemotherapy. Even at the early time point of 3 years and at 5 years, and then impressively at 7 years, all the oncologic outcomes were improved using this triplet TNT approach with improvement in disease-free survival, overall survival, and metastasis-free survival in the experimental arm, which was the use of FOLFIRINOX or triplet chemotherapy. So these studies confirmed the safety and efficacy of TNT by demonstrating improved tumor downstaging, reduced distant recurrence, and better oncologic outcomes, including disease-free survival, as noted in the Prodige 23 study. And this ushered in the idea that TNT was safe, efficacious, and improved oncologic outcomes, and also brought in the idea that it would become a standard of care prior to TME for patients with locally advanced rectal cancer.
Thanks, Dr. Smith. So alongside the rise of TNT, interest also grew in non-operative management for patients achieving a clinical complete response. And the first group to implement a selective non-operative approach with such patients with a clinical complete response was Dr. Habergama's group in 2004. Retrospectively, they compared the outcomes of 71 patients who were observed without surgery after achieving a clinical CR with the outcome of patients who achieved a PathCR after TME. Their results mirrored PathCR rates of 25 to 30% seen in other studies, particularly when using an extended chemoradiation regimen of 54 gray compared to what would we consider the standard of 50.4 gray in patients with early stage low rectal tumors. In that initial study, the overall survival and disease-free survival rates of 5 years were 100% and 92% respectively. in the non-operative group compared to 88 and 83% respectively in the resected group. So this study paved the way for future research into organ preservation in locally advanced rectal cancer. Now, this study was infamously met with skepticism, but gained traction over time. And the principles used by Dr. Habergama's team to assess for clinical CR and monitor for regrowth were adapted to TNT surveillance strategies we use today.
This is a great segue into the case that we'll be discussing today. We have a healthy 54-year-old male diagnosed with an MMR-proficient T3N1M0 rectal adenocarcinoma. He's coming in to discuss treatment options. His tumor sits at 6 centimeters from the anal verge. He has never had surgery before and is otherwise healthy with no significant past medical history. He has heard of watch and wait, or the non-operative management route, and wants more information. To answer this question, we will be discussing Dr. Garcia Aguilar's organ preservation in patients with rectal adenocarcinoma treated with total neoadjuvant therapy, an article published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology in 2022. Dr. Garcia Aguilar, can you please provide us with a summary of the OPRA trial and key takeaways?
Yeah, thank you, Janet. Yeah, I will discuss the design of the OPRA trial. Let me start by saying that designing a prospective trial in organ preservation is difficult because of the need to randomize patients to very different treatments, surgery versus no surgery. So for the OPRA trial, we designed a large phase two study in which patients treated with total neoadjuvant therapy were offered watch and wait or TME based on clinical complete response assessed by endoscopy and MRI approximately 8 weeks after the end of total neoadjuvant therapy. The study primary endpoint was disease-free survival. The hypothesis was that a treatment strategy that will offer watch and wait to patients with a clinical complete response will result in equivalent survival compared to historical controls, patients treated with chemoradiation, TME surgery, and postoperative adjuvant chemotherapy. The study offered the possibility of randomizing patients to the two types of total neoadjuvant therapy that has been described before, chemoradiation followed by systemic chemotherapy versus systemic chemotherapy followed by chemoradiation. And that was a secondary endpoint to compare the organ preservation with those different TME strategies. What we have learned from the trial is that approximately 50% of patients achieve sustained clinical complete response organ preservation. The response rate was slightly higher among patients treated with chemoradiation followed by systemic chemotherapy compared to patients treated with chemotherapy followed by chemoradiation. Survival rates were equivalent to patients treated with the standard treatment of chemoradiation, TME surgery, and postoperative adjuvant chemotherapy. And we didn't find any differences in disease-free survival, overall survival, local recurrence, or distant metastasis between the two treatment arms of the study. We learned that most patients offered watch and wait when to have a sustained clinical complete response, but it was a number of them that developed regrowth during surveillance phase. Most of the regrowths occur within the first 2 years from the time of the assessment or response. You know, there was a difference in the response rate depending on the degree of response. The study offered the possibility of entering into the watch and wait strategy for a patient who had complete clinical response based on defined criteria, but also offer the possibility of a watch and wait to patients with near complete response, those who didn't have complete healing of the tumor site, but they have some characteristics that again were defined in the base of the study. Patients with near complete response had a greater rate of tumor regrowth, but more than half of them still achieved sustained organ preservation. Those are the main findings of the study, that they were observed at 3 years of follow-up, and they were confirmed with, you know, for the follow-up up to 5 years.
Thank you, Dr. Garcia Aguilar. Going back to our clinical case, our patient undergoes TNT and has a near complete response on imaging and endoscopy. Dr. Garcia Aguilar, can you discuss your approach to a patient with a near complete response?
Yeah, in the OPRA trial design, our intent was to give tumor the maximal opportunity to respond. As Dr. Shetler mentioned before, timing of the assessment or response is essential. Rectal cancer takes time to respond, and we wanted patients who did not had a complete clinical response at the time of restaging, give them the opportunity of further observation to determine whether that partial response will turn into a complete response. That's the reason why we offer patients with near complete response the possibility of enter watch and wait. As I mentioned before, half of them still develop a sustained clinical complete response. The question is whether for patients who do not achieve a clinical complete response, we put them at risk of tumor progression during the additional observation. And that emphasized the importance of pretty close clinical surveillance during watch and wait.
Thank you so much. Next, Dr. Focus, I'd like to hear your thoughts on how we can treat our patient case. It would help for us to first discuss some of your work on the CAOAROAIO 12, 16, and 18 trials.
So, yes, thank you for the kind invitation. When it comes to management of patients with near CCR, one of the aspects you need to consider is the duration of TNT. So I don't think we can put all TNT trials into one basket considering the different duration of treatment. And what was very impressive regarding the OPERA trial of Julio Garcia Aguilar was the fact that for the first time, they waited for 34 weeks, that is 8.5 months after treatment initiation, before assessing tumor response and deciding whether patients will be opted for watch and wait in case of CCR, near CCR, or tumor surgery in case of poor response. And this is a key detail that has been ignored for a long time, but we always need to keep it in our mind because the vast majority of TNT trials were characterized by different duration. In our center, now outside clinical trials, we recommend a watch and wait if the patient is happy with our recommendation, but at the same time, we present the case at the MDT and we try to organize a consultation with the surgical department because it's important to us that the patient also hears the opinion and the point of view of the surgeons. And now to the 12th trial, and this abbreviation reflects the three oncological societies of the German oncology community, that's the surgical, the in medical oncology, and the radiation oncology. Like the OPERA, it was a randomized phase 2 study, and randomized TNT with either induction or consolidation chemotherapy, with less chemo. However, the chemoradiotherapy part had a more intensified concomitant chemotherapy protocol that is not only fluoropyrimidines, but 5-FU-oxaliplatin. So the cumulative dose of oxaliplatin for those interested was 500 milligrams, which corresponds to the total dose if you prescribe adjuvant chemotherapy for 3 months in colon cancer. The primary endpoint was PCR. What we owed is that the consolidation chemotherapy resulted in superior PCR rates, that was 25%, compared to induction chemotherapy, that was 17%. Few patients rejected surgery, albeit the clinical design indicated that TME was compulsory. So the cumulative PCR-CCR rates were 28% for the consolidation chemotherapy arm and 21% for the induction. Why we did this trial? This was a pick the winner design. The reason why we did that was because we wanted to choose the best TNT arm to test the efficacy for organ preservation in the next generation trial, that was the 16, the 18. Before I proceed to the 16 trial of the German group, I want to mention that the long-term analysis indicated that there was no difference between the two groups regarding the other secondary oncological endpoints, anorectal function, and toxicity. Now, the 16 was led by Ciangani from the University of Tübingen. For that, we chose the group B of the 12 trial, that is chemoradiotherapy first, followed by consolidation chemotherapy with 3 cycles of FOLFOX. And similar to the OPERA, we performed analysis of response at 2 different time points in case of patients with a very good or near CCR. Now, this trial indicated CCR rates of 40%. Surprisingly, Despite the trial design, many patients were operated. The PCR rate in this trial was 28%. This reflects, I think, uncertainty of some of the centers during the first period before they became familiar with assessing response as part of the watch and wait program. Since then, we have moved forward. Very important, though, and this is the reason why we advocate watch and wait. But the TME group was characterized by significantly worse anorectal, urogenital function, and of course, quality of life compared to the subgroup of patients that were opted for watch and wait because of CCR. And this is the reason why we do advocate watch and wait. There is no other reason. Now, following the completion of the 16, we're very happy that to see the CCR and PCR rates. Why? Because at the same time, or shortly afterwards, we initiated the 18.1. It was a large randomized phase 3 study and compared TNT per rapido, that is 5x5, followed by CAPOX or FOLFOX over a period of 16 to 18 weeks. And in group B was the continuation or further development of our 12 and 16 trial concept, that is chemoradiotherapy first, intensified concomitant chemo protocol with 5-FU oxaliplatin, followed by either 6 cycles of FOLFOX or 4 cycles of CAPOX. So we did this trial following publication or presentation of the RAPIDO, because the RAPIDO indicated an improvement in one of the key oncological endpoints, that was DFS. The hypothesis is that chemoradiotherapy-based TNT will lead to an improvement in the 3-year organ preservation rate, the primary endpoint, from 30% per rapido to 40% according to our group with the chemoradiotherapy. Trial complete accrual in September 23 with 702 patients. And this is the first trial that I have seen personally that completed accrual 2 years before initial projection or the projected time. Why? The reason was, of course, the very good multidisciplinary teamwork, the support from the German Cancer Aid that has been funding our trial. But I think the most important reason is because patients with rectal cancer, especially of the lower third, do want to be treated as part of studies that assess and test the concept of organ preservation. This is definitely a paradigm-changing era, and we're very excited to complete this trial, and we very much hope to be able to present to you and the community the data early next year. Now, last point I want to touch upon was the slight controversy that we have all experienced during the last period regarding whether it is safe to advocate organ preservation. There has been some skepticism, especially regarding the outcome of patients with near CCR. I think the data are excellent when it comes to CCR. You have a DFS OS over 90%. And of course, we have the other extreme, that is poor response. In this case, you definitely need to operate. But for patients with near CCR, you always wonder, if I actually advocate a restaging 3 months, will this lead to a worsening of the oncological endpoint? So with this in mind, the German group and the OPERA group with Professor Aguilar and Professor Smith decided to conduct a pooled analysis that we published earlier this year. There was a pooled analysis of the 12th trial of the German group and the OPERA. I think this is the best evidence to compare the clinical outcome between two randomized TNT studies that randomized or tested the two different TNT sequences. And I encourage the community to read the paper, because we could show that for the different response groups based on clinical and pathological response assessment, the DFS and OS were completely comparable. So in patients with, there was no difference in the outcome between patients that had a near CCR assessed clinically and patients that had intermediate pathological response according to the Dvorak system established since 25, 30 years ago by the German group. But I'm sure Professor Aguilar would like to add to it.
Thank you, Professor Foca. Not much to add. I think, as I mentioned before, the design of the OPERA trial was in reality a single arm in which patients with response, complete response to total neoadjuvant therapy will be offered watch and wait or TME based on the response. We initially powered the study based on historical controls, and I think the study that has been later published by Professor Foca and his group from Germany is because of the design with similar, not exactly the same, but similar TNT strategies represents the best control arm. So in the absence of a prospective randomized trial, probably this is the strongest evidence in support of a treatment strategy for locally advanced rectal cancer that offers watch and wait to patients with a complete response. And I agree, it's a paper that should be read because the grade of response assessed by endoscopy and MRI after the TNT is an excellent predictor of long-term outcomes, and this is validated with the pathology grading that was performed in the German trial. So it's again, probably the best validation that we have for the watch and wait strategy.
Thank you, Dr. Foca and Dr. Garcia Aguilar. It seems like we all have some reading to do. So for our case of a 54-year-old male with locally advanced rectal cancer, what treatment options would you offer the patient from our clinical case based on the evidence we have today?
Dr. Schlechter, I'm interested in your thoughts given the data from the medical oncology standpoint. Where do you start as you discuss these data with your patients?
Yeah, so the first thing I would say about the whole picture of modern rectal cancer therapy is I think it's really impressive that the surgeons have driven the dialogue and the research on doing less surgery, that doing non-operative management. Whereas very often, I think in the medical oncology world, we have a more chemo is more better. And I think an example of that is the Prodige 23, where more chemo was really the thing being studied. I think patients have to have a voice here. So for a lower rectal cancer that's node positive, for patients interested in non-operative management or function, I would tend to advocate for the OPERA approach, you know, chemoradiotherapy followed by chemotherapy, getting as much time from radiation to consideration of surgery as possible, getting the most bang for your buck from the time effect of chemoradiotherapy, getting in all of your chemotherapy and hoping for non-operative management. For patients where the tumor is higher, for patients where radiation is a concern, or patients where an ostomy is less of an issue, I think we can also think about de-escalating therapy. Once again, rather than de-escalating away from surgery, which has been the whole sort of TNT and opportunistic non-operative management dialogue, but thinking about TNT approaches or perioperative approaches that avoid radiation. And that would be the PROSPECT trial, where patients who had a T3, T2, N1 cancer, who had no risk of sphincter preservation, who would undergo sphincter-preserving surgeries, LAR, could receive chemotherapy only. And if they have a good response, avoid radiation entirely, and those patients had good functional outcomes. But I think for a tumor quite this low, I would tend to recommend the OPERA approach over the PROSPECT approach of avoiding radiation de-escalating. There are those who would argue strongly that FOLFIRINOX, based on Prodige 23, is the way to go because of that DFS benefit that we see in OS benefit in long-term follow-up. I would just make the nuanced point that the control arm in that trial was a little bit undertreated. And so I don't know that I would take a T3N1 cancer and escalate all the way to a toxic regimen like FOLFIRINOX until we have the results of your trial, the modern JANUS trial, looking at FOLFIRINOX in this setting, and really in a randomized setting, looking at escalated chemotherapy versus standard chemotherapy, FOLFIRINOX versus FOLFOX, really proving the benefit in a well-controlled study. And of course, we also have AIO studies doing the same thing. And so I think it comes up to what the patient wants, but I would tend towards an OPERA approach in this particular situation.
That's great. Dr. Foca, from the European standpoint, do you think in the absence of data from your current phase 3 trial, do you see a trend toward a more TNT type approach given the OPERA data, or are you still are waiting for the data from your trial, for example, in the management of this patient?
Yes. Thank you so much for the question. It's a key question because following the publication of the 5-year data on the RAPIDO trial that indicated worse rates of locoregional failure in the TNT group with 5x5, at least in Germany, the surgical community has become very reserved in advocating TNT with short course radiotherapy, even though we, as radiation oncologists, are the first one who say that, you know, it's important to wait for the phase 3 data of our 18.1 trial. Nevertheless, we have already experienced a shift nationally towards TNT with chemoradiotherapy. I think following the initial enthusiasm of the first 2 years upon presentation of the Rapido at the ASCO 2020, the community has reconsidered its options. And I think it's a valid point because 10% local failure is an unacceptably high rate. We still don't understand why this happened. And it is very concerning considering that this occurred in a country with excellent health system, that is the Netherlands, with centralized health system, with very high quality surgical oncology standards. So I'm wondering if that happened in the Netherlands, how the outcome looks in countries with less centralized health system, with less subspecialization and less high volume centers. So at the moment, nationally, and I think in Europe, most centers prefer TNT with long course chemoradiotherapy.
That's very helpful. And Dr. Garcia Aguilar, what do you think currently in the US, what do you think the trend is in the absence of the data from Dr. Focus trial, from our recently completed Janus trial, the Japanese trial? How do you think this patient is being managed from your perspective?
Yeah, I think I agree with what has been said by Ben and by Manos. This patient, after a discussion outlining what the goals of the treatment are, if the patient is interested in organ preservation, he will probably be treated with chemoradiation followed by consolidation chemotherapy. Again, we're waiting for the results of the phase 3 trial from Germany. But I think for the most part in the United States, the standard now would be chemoradiation followed by chemotherapy if the goal is organ preservation.
The one point I would add actually would be how symptomatic he is. You know, one of the important findings from Purdue 23, I thought, was the analysis that for the most symptomatic patients, starting with chemotherapy led to symptomatic improvement more quickly. Again, if his organ function right now was pretty good, he wasn't really suffering that much, I would definitely recommend an OPRA approach. But if sometimes you have a rectal cancer, you know, at 6 centimeters, it's pretty miserable. And for those patients, they do get better quickly with FOLFIRINOX. And I think that's the one situation where, unless the patient is adamantly opposed to the risk of an ostomy, I would pretend to offer FOLFIRINOX in that particular situation, which is a little bit beyond the randomized data, but I do think it's worth considering because ultimately we're not changing overall survival in most of these approaches, and it's really about function and quality of life. And so using chemotherapy to improve quality of life is a consideration in this situation, although I think in this particular patient, OPRA is the way to go.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree. That's a very good point because at the end of the day, the difference in organ preservation between the induction and consolidation arm is not huge. It's still close to 40% of the patients who start with systemic chemotherapy can achieve organ preservation. So I think that is a very good point and well taken.
Yeah, it is a good point. Dr. Focus, I wonder if you could comment just on timing to get radiation started and also the improvement of symptoms from your perspective.
So nationally and in Europe, we had endless conversations for almost 2.5 years how to update the clinical guidelines. And again, for those interested, I encourage you to read the ESMO. They look pretty similar to the national German, or the German look pretty similar to the ESMO. To cut the long story short, we have two different clinical settings. So we have two separate algorithms for the two fundamental different clinical settings. The first one is the surgical, and the second one is the setting of organ preservation. And hard as it is, you need to decide at the beginning, of course, as part of the shared decision making with your patient and upon presentation of the case at the MDT, whether the aim of the treatment is organ preservation or not. If the aim is organ preservation, we have no data on the role of induction chemotherapy. However, we have trials ongoing on chemo, and we look forward to them. In fact, there is a trial completed in France for patients with intermediate risk that compared FOLFIRINOX versus chemoradiotherapy. But if the aim is surgery, of course, you can start with chemotherapy, especially for those patients, if that's the recommendation of the MDT. It is a valuable and absolutely valid option.
Thank you all so much for those insights. It sounds like there is definitely ongoing research in total knee adjuvant therapy that we have to stay tuned in with, including the role of immunotherapy.
Hi, everyone. Scott here, and we're going to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, Figs. If you've been here before, you know we love sharing surgical pearls and pitfalls, practical, high-yield takeaways to help you dominate the day, from the classroom to the operating room and beyond. And since you're in it to win it, we ought to clue you into a game changer, and that's Figs. Figs are scrubs made for modern medicine. The fabric is lightweight and breathable with four-way stretch, and it's moisture-wicking plus antimicrobial to prevent odor and bacteria. What really sets Figs apart is the intelligent design with pocket size for stethoscopes and trauma shears, adjustable draw cords, and precision fit silhouettes. Oh, and they also come in a ton of styles and colors to choose from. From the big stuff down to the little details, Figs really thinks about what health professionals like us need, and they deliver every time.
With the holidays right around the corner, it's a perfect time to treat yourself to some fresh looks for the new year, which is great because Figs just dropped a ton of new limited edition colors and styles for the season. If you want to check them out, Figs is offering 15% off your first purchase at wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX. Now back to the show.
During our last podcast, we had an in-depth discussion with Dr. Sirsik and Dr. Yu about early onset colorectal cancer, including the role of immunotherapy for MMR-deficient rectal cancer patients. But what about MSS tumors? Dr. Schlechter, are you able to give us information on the role of immunotherapy in MSS colorectal cancer patients?
I'm happy to. The first thing I would say is mature data is lacking. So everything I'm going to talk about is aspirational oncology as opposed to established oncology. Last year in Nature Medicine, I and Dr. Bullock published on a regimen combination called botensilimab with balstilimab. Botensilimab is a next-generation CTLA-4 inhibitor, and it really is a differentiated drug after the tremelimumab, ipilimumabs of the world. This is kind of the next CTLA-4, and it does some different things. It improves clearance of regulatory T cells. It improves activation of the immune system and results in responses, we believe, in a large phase 1 trial and a presented phase 2 randomized trial in advanced colorectal cancer. So that's important. And importantly, we don't see responses in the liver. We see them outside of the liver. And there's a lot of nuance there we can discuss in another setting. There have been three clinical trials looking at botensilimab with balstilimab in colon cancer, not really rectal cancer, but colon cancer in the neoadjuvant setting. There's the NEST-1 and NEST-2 trial. And then there's the UNICORN study coming out of the Gona group in Italy, NEST-1 and NEST-2 are from New York. What they showed was that botensilimab followed by balstilimab does improve clinical complete responses in patients undergoing resection of a colon cancer. It begs the question whether we could use a similar approach in rectal cancer, and we're actively applying for funding and investigating this, and this is a really, really important option to think about. But as of now, I would not offer botensilimab and balstilimab as new adjuvant therapy for rectal cancer, but I think it's a really appealing idea because this is a combination with significant responses compared to conventional checkpoint inhibitors. So that's the new drug is the botensilimab, balstilimab, and I'm sure other companies are going to start trying to make botensilimab competitors because it's a powerful drug and it's an important drug and it's entering phase 3 trial for registration in refractory disease, and hopefully we can get that trial quickly into early stage disease and help patients with rectal cancer using the immune therapy approach. There have been two phase 2s worth knowing about in total neoadjuvant therapy in combination with PD-1 inhibitors. So there's the TORCH study, and that was a short course radiation paradigm, and then every patient received the same amount of CAPOX plus an immune checkpoint inhibitor. I always have trouble pronouncing this one. It's toripalimab. So toripalimab is a PD-1, similar to nivolumab or pembrolizumab, for example. That trial looked at short course radiation followed by a TNT approach, similar to Rapido, or some amount of chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and then radiation, and then additional chemoimmunotherapy. And what it showed was that the radiation-first approach was better. I actually think this really was looking at a radiation first versus radiation midway through therapy, as opposed to the plus or minus immune therapy. And pretty much every trial we've discussed, the longer you wait from radiation, the better your local control effect is. And so my guess is that TORCH demonstrates the safety of the combination of short course radiation followed by this PD-1 inhibitor in CAPOX, but doesn't necessarily say that it's better. It does look good compared to historic controls, but I don't think historic controls are really valid in a curative intent therapy approach. So there was another trial looking at an immune checkpoint inhibitor, also a PD-1 called sintilimab, and that was combined with CAPOX. So it was CAPOX followed by chemoradiotherapy, followed by surgery and non-operative management with plus or minus sintilimab. And that did show a trend toward an improvement in non-operative management in those patients. We don't have overall survival data yet. But the important thing about that was a really straightforward randomization of plus or minus immune checkpoint inhibitors using kind of what I would describe as the losing arm of OPRA. It was a radiation second, not radiation first approach. And so I think we really do need a radiation first approach followed by chemotherapy plus or minus immune checkpoint inhibitors. There's a couple other points I would make. I could go on for an hour, but I'll try to be fast. Radiation followed by chemo and immune therapy is an important question to ask. I think we have to ask what's the right immune therapy. The benefit we're seeing with botensilimab, I think, speaks to the role of CTLA-4. And most of these trials are using PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors. And those are different drugs and they work in different ways. The other important point I would make is that the presence of the in situ nodes and the in situ primary and the in situ pyrus patches in the immune system of the rectum may enhance the ability of immune therapy to work. So we have to think about our trial designs and think about the role of neoadjuvant therapy versus adjuvant therapy. I would strongly suggest that neoadjuvant approaches are most important when we're thinking about immune therapy in these so-called colder tumors. We need the training ground of the immune system, which is the lymph nodes. We may have to think about the role of radiation. It could be that the biologically effective dose of short course radiation, which is a little bit less than the biologically effective dose of long course radiotherapy, maybe it's less lymphotoxic, and maybe a short course followed by PD-1, which is an easier drug to tolerate, will be better than the long course. We have to test all of these questions before they enter prime time. But I think we had our pre-TME era, we had our TME era, we have our TNT, non-operative management era, and hopefully we can enter a post-TME era with the combination of chemoradiotherapy or radiation therapy, a long gap filled with chemotherapy and immune therapy, and increasing amounts of complete responses in non-operative management. And that's really aspiration, I think, of this generation of clinical trials.
Thank you so much for that. Do you see this taking the place of a current treatment modality overall?
I hope it can do that with time, right? The best thing that we can achieve with chemotherapy and immune therapy and radiation therapy and all these modalities is to avoid some modalities. And I think surgery is the modality that we want to avoid. As I said, this has been work led by surgeons to do less rectal surgery. I don't think we're putting colorectal surgeons out of business in the rectum, but I think if we can get more patients avoiding APR, more patients avoiding LAR syndrome, that would be beneficial. But we have a real long way to go. And I would not underestimate rectal cancer's ability to resist immune therapy. So I think, yes, this is going to be part of the de-escalation approaches, but I don't think any of the above approaches are going away.
Yeah, I think those are great points. I'm interested to see what Dr. Garcia Aguilar and Dr. Focas think, because really important points here about trying to turn cold tumors hot in the context of radiation, Dr. Focas, and then Dr. Garcia Aguilar. I know this is something you've been thinking about a little bit, so be interested to get your insight.
Ben, great overview of what is known now about immune checkpoint blockade in the rectal cancer and perspective for the future. But the success of the immune checkpoint blockade so far, the great success has been in a properly selected patients, the one that they have, you know, MSI, the high tumor mutation burden. Based on data from Chalabi and others, the proportion of tumors, MMR proficient, that they would be expected to respond to immune checkpoint blockade is limited. Have you thought about the idea of using some biomarkers to select the patients that will be exposed to a potentially toxic treatment as the combination that you were describing, BOT/BAL?
Yeah, with BOT/BAL, we don't have enough data yet. You know, fewer than 1,000 patients have probably received that agent. So there just isn't enough high-quality biomarker data in these particular diseases to predict who are the winners and who are the losers. We just have to do the trials. The biomarker data that we do have, there's a number of immune scores for conventional PD-1s. Yeah, we can slightly better predict who's a winner and who's a loser in these paradigms. I don't think that we have found anything particularly practice-changing. PD-1 staining, PD-L1 staining on the tumor doesn't really seem to make a huge difference in predicting outcomes, probably because so-called cold tumors like rectal cancer, they're pushing back against the immune system in different ways than, say, lung cancer or melanoma. And so those scoring systems that we use in those diseases probably just don't apply.
Yes, if I may add to the immunotherapy. So Dr. Schlechter mentioned earlier that short-course radiotherapy as part of TNT for combination with immunotherapy might be the better approach. And so far, we have evidence that this might be the case. Inconvenient as it might be, as we are still waiting to see the data of the 18.1 trial, but I want to highlight two studies that were presented this year at the ESTRO Congress. This is the European Radiation Oncology Conference that took place in May. The one is the PRIME-RT from the Scottish group, Campbell Roxburgh, who combined short course and long course based TNT with durvalumab, and this small trial indicated better response rates in favor of TNT with short course radiotherapy when you combine it with the PD-L1 immune checkpoint inhibitor durvalumab. The second trial I want to highlight is the STELLAR-2 by the Chinese group. So this is the continuation of STELLAR-1. The substance was sintilimab, if I remember correctly, PD-1 inhibitor. So they present the phase 2 data, but bear in mind that the phase 3 trial recruitment has already been completed and indicated very high response rates when you combine TNT with short course with PD-1 immune checkpoint inhibition. And this, together with the other 9 studies published on different combinations of immunotherapy with different immune checkpoint inhibitors, indicate that we might have got the biology, at least in part, a bit wrong. And maybe rectal cancer is not as a cold tumor as we have been thinking. And if it was that cold, we wouldn't have seen such impressive data. So this theory that it is definitely a very cold tumor might need a bit of reconsideration. I guess we cannot extrapolate the data from colon cancer to rectal cancer. This is what this data from the first 10, 11 trials in immunotherapy indicate. But as Dr. Schlechter mentioned, we need longer follow-up, more mature data, and of course, phase 3 trial results. But from what we have seen so far, if you combine TNT with immunotherapy, might be better to use short-course radiotherapy, A, and B, we cannot extrapolate the biology of colon cancer to rectal cancer, and maybe rectal cancer is not as cold immunogenically as we thought.
Yeah, along with what Dr. Foga was saying, I mean, we have done some tracheotomic analysis in rectal cancer, and then it's a small subset, but significantly higher than the MSI tumor, though they are immune hot based on the expression of genes or the immune signature from being there. So that's maybe something in the future. What is the response of that particular subset of the rectal tumors? Now, but also you both bring an interesting point about the issue of the type of radiation and the issue of response and the impact of radiation in the lymphatic microenvironment in the rectal area. If we take that question to the extreme, why not just do focal radiation to the primary and forget about the mesorectum? What about the possibility of using contact radiation with high dose to the primary tumor, trying to spare the mesorectum to the best of our ability? I don't know if you guys got any thought about that or any option for additional trials.
This is an excellent point. And in fact, there are 3 ongoing randomized studies, and all 3 come from China, exactly on this question. So this is TNT-based approach, randomized. In the standard arm, both the primary tumor and the pelvic lymph node areas, that is iliac internal, obturator, and presacral lymph nodes, are irradiated per standard protocol. And in the experimental group, instead of irradiated both the primary tumor and the pelvic lymph node areas, you only irradiate the primary tumor. And it will be interesting to see whether this will be associated with higher response rates. But we have known this since a long time ago that chemoradiotherapy and radiotherapy are associated with lymphodepletion. Lymphopenia is very common. We have kind of overlooked it for a long time because in the vast majority of patients, it is asymptomatic. Patients, so you take blood, you conduct a differential blood value analysis, and you see a high grade of lymphopenia, and then you ask the patient how you feel, and you see there is no symptoms, no infection signs. So you carry on giving chemotherapy. which is fine. But in the context of immunotherapy, this approach needs reconsideration. And what you mentioned, Julio, is absolutely spot on. I think we're going to see very interesting data in the years to come, exactly on this point from China. To my understanding or knowledge, there is no data either from Europe or from the US on this scientific question.
Yeah, it's a great point. And what we're lymphodepleting matters, right? We want to lymphodeplete regulatory T cells and myeloid-derived suppressor cells inside the tumor. We want to leave some lymph node intact as a training ground. I also think we need better immune therapies. PD-1 is about taking an established immune response and preventing it from exhausting and failing. I think we also need to think about activating more immune responses. That's really what the concept behind botensilimab is. So we need to be thoughtful about our radiation dosing and designs and fields. We need to be thoughtful about the immune checkpoint inhibitors we're using. And, you know, we've been constrained by enthusiasm for PD-L1 and PD-1 inhibitors because they're so safe and easy. But we may have actually missed out on CTLA-4 and other immune checkpoint pathways where there are important steps in activating the immune response that for a generation we've avoided because we're worried about toxicity. We're better at toxicity now and with immune therapy. So I think we should try and do better immune therapy in addition to addressing exhaustion of the immune response.
Yeah, these are fantastic points. And I hope the Behind the Knife listeners recognize that we have some gold nuggets coming out of this episode from three really, really brilliant clinicians and scientists. So thank you, each of you, for those insights. Dr. Bauer and I are going to end the episode by talking about trials in progress and some next steps. So as mentioned by Dr. Focus, the ongoing 18.1 trial that's now completed, I think you mentioned, Manos, 2 years ahead of time, right? So I think this is instructive to the community that when you have a watch and wait option in a modern rectal cancer trial, that this is really important. And he also mentioned that the idea of reducing toxicity, improving quality of life by having that option is critically important. And just as a reminder, that randomized essentially the Rapido approach versus what was found to be the arm in OPRA that had the highest rate of organ preservation. So short course TNT approach versus a long course TNT approach. And that trial will read out, I think you mentioned earlier, Manos, sometime next year.
Yes.
So that'll be very instructive, and we look forward to seeing the data from that trial. In addition, the trial that's happening in Japan, and I think this is notable because in Japan, prior to starting this, that TNT was not done. And so this is a notable trial because it's using a short course approach followed by triplet chemotherapy versus short course and long and doublet chemotherapy with a watch and wait approach. And the important thing about these TNT trials, and they've also adopted the three-tiered approach that Dr. Garcia Aguilar mentioned in terms of assessing tumor response, endoscopy, exam, MRI. And so we'll have a number of trials which can unify all of these regression criteria in future, which could also be important if we want to do a pooled analysis similar to what Dr. Focus and Dr. Garcia Aguilar did with the German trial and the OPRA trial in future. And then in the US, we just completed the Janus rectal cancer trial, which compared OPRA, which is long course, and then doublet chemotherapy as the control arm versus the experimental arm, which is long course, followed by triplet chemotherapy. Again, with the idea that selective watch and wait in those patients with a clinical complete response could be integrated in the trial. It was a seamless phase 2 to phase 3 trial. This trial also accrued a year and a half ahead of time. The end result was 783 patients accrued in this phase 3 portion, which was disease-free survival. The phase 2 portion was clinical complete response. And this is an Alliance trial that, by report, is the fastest accruing Alliance trial to date. And so we're excited to see those results, but we'll need to wait a little while to get the results, and we'll report out CCR and DFS at the same time. The CHOW trial, which is ongoing in Brazil, is very interesting because it's comparing long course and then the capecitabine approach versus long course and FOLFOX. And this is important because it's testing this TNT type approach in Brazil in a prospective trial in South America, which I think is important because it's building on the work that Dr. Garcia Aguilar did in the TIMON trial, which was mentioned earlier. But instead of mandatory TME, those patients are being offered an option for watch and wait. So I'll leave it to Dr. Bauer to help us in the episode.
One thing I'm very interested in is we talked a little bit about what modalities we can start to eliminate for select patients. We touched on the PROSPECT trial and the selective use of chemoradiation, but can we expand that to treating these patients non-operatively after, you know, neoadjuvant chemotherapy alone? So that trial showed, you know, nearly a 25% PCR rate in patients treated with just neoadjuvant chemo. You know, can we selectively watch and wait some of those patients? I think that would be very interesting. We also touched quite a bit on the role of chemoimmunotherapy. One thing we didn't really talk about today is the role of circulating tumor DNA in disease surveillance and management, and, you know, how we define the predictive role of ctDNA versus, you know, simply the prognostic features of this assay. Dr. Smith, do you have any more perspective on ctDNA?
Yeah, I think people know that this is ctDNA is prognostic. That's not a surprise, but whether or not it's predictive and its utility, especially in making the decision about whether we would recommend a patient pursue watch and wait or not, is still to be determined. And, you know, we collected plasma and we'll use this as an exploratory analysis in Janus. And I know Manos did the same. And I believe, Julio, you have some analysis in OPRA that could be instructive in this space. So I would say this is an area of active investigation, but are we ready to make any decisions based on ctDNA in rectal cancer in the absence of data from prospective trials? I would say no, but be interested to hear what Julio, Ben, and Manos think.
I think, yes, we need more data. We are not ready for prime time. Yeah, the ctDNA, we have found at baseline during treatment, after treatment, can predict outcomes. When it comes to identify patient with response, I'm a little bit more skeptical in patients treated with chemoradiation and systemic chemotherapy. We have to remember that there is 8-10% of patients who achieve a clinical complete response and still develop distal metastasis. That's always going to be a confounding factor. That doesn't happen in patients treated with immunotherapy, because usually the pathological response of the primary tumor, at least in the information that we have from MSK, is always associated with a complete eradication of the metastatic disease. So I think in that domain, the ctDNA is going to be very, very valuable. We need to see what is going to happen in patients treated with conventional chemoradiation or systemic chemotherapy when the eradication of metastatic disease is not 100%. That might be a confounding factor at the time of deciding whether the patient is a candidate for, you know, organ preservation or not. I don't know if anyone has a different perspective. That's kind of a little bit our experience and our thoughts.
I agree with both of you, Jos and Julio. There is a group in Australia that are currently assessing treatment approach using ctDNA, especially for patients that have clinical complete response. There are some limitations to the technology, albeit I'm not an expert. I think probably the least qualified person to talk about this topic. But from what I have read, if I remember correctly, not all patients show have detectable ctDNA, cfDNA in blood at the baseline, similar to CA. So I think this is a limitation. We cannot use it for all patients. B, what you're going to do if you have increase in ctDNA and then you conduct radiological analysis, so like CT scan, MRI, PET-CT, you don't find anything, which appears to be the case from what I have read. So detection is earlier compared to the development of macroscopic recurrence, either locally or distally. So what are you going to do with that? I think apart from the practical questions, there are some ethical questions. What do you say to the patient? Do you start chemotherapy even though early restaging using CT scan, MRI or PET-CT showed no signs of local or distant recurrence? That's not a trivial question to answer. I think this needs lots of consideration, careful thinking, careful approach. I think it will be important, like in colon cancer, to maybe have a trial where upon increase or redetection of ctDNA in patients with initial clinical complete response, in suspicion of regrowth, then you have randomization to either closer follow-up or intervention. But the question is, what are you going to do? Are you going to give chemotherapy even though the patient will not have any metastasis or local recurrence? Or you wait until this will be detected and then you give intervention? Because treatment is completed. Treatment is completed. And if patients have received TNT, some of them cannot take any more systemic therapy, at least aggressive full dose chemo. So I think there are lots of open questions, but it's certainly a very exciting scientific question.
Yeah, I completely agree. And let's just keep in mind, we don't know the overall survival. We should wait for that. Because it could be that an MRD positive, ctDNA positive patient that we offer additional chemo to alters the biology. You might have taken some with resectable oligometastatic disease and enhanced all the anti-death pathways of this cancer as you tried to injure it. And what you're left with is actually a more aggressive malignancy that is not surgically oligometastatic, but actually is systemic disease that we can't resect because ultimately surgery is the cure of cancer, at least in colorectal cancer. So I would say far too soon. The only other point I would add is the assay matters. There's tumor-informed assays. You're looking for evidence of this actual tumor in the blood. And there's the uninformed assays. I think we just kind of need to move beyond the uninformed assays. Those definitely are going to give us, I think, the least information.
I think this can be useful in the era of more aggressive therapeutic approaches for oligometastatic tumors. I think it can potentially be a very valuable tool to recommend closer or more intensive follow-up. So maybe every 2 months instead of every 3 months or every 6 months, with the aim of introducing early potentially curative treatment if the patient develops oligorecurrence or oligometastatic disease. But this is only one thought of mine.
Sure. Well, these are great thoughts and a lot of exciting things as it relates to potential use for circulating tumor DNA. Also, a lot of exciting work in the biomarker space, you know, potentially using radiomics, AI-based approaches for sustained responders, those that have a near complete response. We talked and touched a little bit about immunotherapy and maybe, you know, immunotherapy combined with chemo, in addition to the sequence of potentially using short course versus long course, some interesting studies that are yet to be published that but were recently presented were brought up. And so a lot of exciting studies as we think about what's the next frontier in total neoadjuvant therapy in mismatch repair proficient tumors and how do we make these what is thought to be cold tumors hot. So we also touched a little bit about this idea of near complete response. And I think work from OPRA importantly showed that these patients can still avoid surgery because we know that about half of these patients can still preserve the organ and turn from a near complete response to a clinical complete response given additional time. And so the trials that we've mentioned still have this opportunity for these patients with a near complete response to evolve to a complete response and safely enter the watch and wait pathway. And this will be validated in the ongoing trials that were recently mentioned. So a lot of important things that will still be validated and further studied as we move forward in the modern era of ENT and locally advanced rectal cancer.
This has been such an excellent discussion about multiple trials, multiple articles. I hope that our Behind the Knife listeners take some time to absorb this information and also look up the articles and do some own reading. Main takeaways from today, we have learned that the German rectal cancer trial established preoperative chemoradiotherapy followed by surgery, STME, as the standard of care, reducing local recurrence, but this left gaps in systemic disease control. This served as a building block for future seminal rectal cancer trials, which have changed the paradigm of treatment for patients with rectal cancer. Second, many patients were unable to complete postoperative chemotherapy due to surgical morbidity or treatment delays, allowing micrometastatic disease to progress, which contributed to mortality. Total neoadjuvant therapy moves chemotherapy and radiation before surgery, ensuring patients receive full systemic treatment, targeting micrometastases earlier, improving response rates. Improved response rates led to exploration of organ preservation approaches, such as watch and wait, and patients are enthusiastic about this approach as it improves quality of life by deferral of surgery and avoidance of possible temporary or permanent stomas. Current studies are refining total neoadjuvant therapy regimens, such as short course versus long course, induction versus consolidation chemo, triplet versus doublet chemotherapy regimens, exploring selective omission of treatment, organ preservation strategies, ctDNA-based surveillance, and integration of immunotherapy for more personalized treatment. Thank you to everyone. I really appreciate everyone taking the time to discuss with us today. The Colorectal Oncology Surgery team looks forward to our next Behind the Knife podcast, and thank you all for listening.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple, iOS, and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.